Please tell me what you're feeling.
There's a man out there I haven't seen in 15 years who's trying to kill me. You show me his son, I'd be happy to help him. My son. My life that could have been. It wasn't. What am I feeling? Old. Worn out.
Let me show you something. Make you feel young as when the world was new.
Now, Whom Pods Destroy.
Welcome to Whom Pods Destroy, a Star Trek discussion podcast. I'm Terry, and as usual, I'm joined by Derek.
Hello.
And by Graham.
Hello.
Well, chaps, as we're recording this now, we're mere days away from the third season of Star Trek Discovery. So we've got, you know, it's a interesting and brave new frontier that they've cast for themselves, and we'll wait with interest to see what the reception is like from the fan base, which I don't think Star Trek Discovery is universally popular with certain sections of the community, and I would imagine that this is likely to ruffle a few more feathers, and so I'm quite looking forward to it.
That's a good thing, though, isn't it, that it's not universally accepted? Shouldn't it be challenging the fans?
I think you're right. I think it should be, and I think it also should be speaking to a new generation of fans and a new audience who will have different sensibilities, and they'll have a different palette. And will want to, they won't want to see stuff that looks like and feels like and has the same tone and the same structure as fifth season Next Generation or sixth season DS9 or any season of Voyager, for example. I don't believe that kind of storytelling is relevant anymore, and I think that's one of the reasons why I think people don't like Discovery, is because it's jarring by comparison to, you know, what they would regard as sort of classic Trek.
It does depend on the punter, because I mean, I've got some work colleagues who aren't die-in-the-wall Star Trek fans who are actually looking forward to it. Yeah. They want something new on telly.
Well, I think that's my point, really. I think that you have to be careful about bridging the gap between what is essentially fan service and what is also, you know, actually telling stories to the vast majority of your audience who aren't necessarily going to be fans. And this has been the story of Star Trek, I think, for a long time, and actually when it does it well, it pitches it just about right, and it speaks to its fan base, but it also speaks to a new audience. And I think an ideal example of that is Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, which is, funnily enough, the topic of our podcast today. Isn't that good?
It certainly is.
It is good.
It is very good.
I mean, it's just like you prepared it.
It's almost as though I may well have prepared that. because believe it or not, chap, Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan wasn't universally popular amongst the fandom. I remember listening at a convention to Larry Nemechek, who I'm sure you guys are aware of, a Trek historian and author of various Trek history books and, you know, friend to the Trek stars, and he saw Star Trek II as kind of really eschewing sort of like Reaganite philosophy and reflecting the Reaganite populism of the time. Interestingly, the casting of Starfleet more as a military and nautical organisation rather than Roddenberry's perception of non-military, and it was that surprised me a lot. And the way that he spoke, I don't think he was alone in that opinion. That he was, you know, it was 1981, 1982 when he saw it, and he would have only seen motion picture and then TAS and TOS, and that would have been his you know, understanding of Star Trek lore, and it would have been heavily influenced by Roddenberry, and may well have actually been quite jarring how different in tone in many respects that was. I don't know whether or not, does that, you look surprised or nonplussed by that news? No, does it surprise me?
I'm not surprised by that, because it does have the whole narrative of the design and the scripting as well does have a lot more sort of nautical references. This is a bit more Hornblower than, and certainly you've got the, obviously the Moby Dick references that go all the way through it as well. So it does have that sort of nautical theme, which I suppose can lend itself to the sort of more militaristic. It's there's a lot of shiny braid in this, isn't there? The uniforms are a lot more starched, aren't they? And there are a lot more buckles on them.
Yeah.
And so there is that feeling about it. But I suppose that is sort of like lending more into the whole sort of thought of it being tall ships rather than starships. The bosun's whistle and the
nautical bell that you could hear in the background while Kirk's walking through the corridor.
And even the way they speak to each other, the word is given, you know, it's all this sort of stuff lends itself to that sort of thing as well. And I suppose as well, you've also got the fact that it's meant to be a cadet cruise as well, so you've got lots of underlings in there as well, so there is the stratas. It is very clear, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
It's a natural progression, because I mean the thing is with regards to an organisation, a military organisation, because it is a military organisation and it's always been a military organisation through TOS, because of the ranks system. You have captains. Oh, sorry, you were going to say
No, I disagree.
Not.
No, I was. I'm going to let you finish your point.
Well, I was going to say
then that I'm going to choke you to death with it.
Yeah, you are. I always sort of saw, because of the rank situation, of the ranks are near enough, they are naval ranks.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and the idea about ships, you know, the whole, it was like it's a space navy. I mean, in Star Trek II, it is defined as being a space navy. You know, and I do agree with you that the ante's been pushed up, and it creates as we've said before, the thing about good drama, you need good conflict, and here they've actually purposely went out of their way later on to have a conflict between you know, the military and the scientists, unlike the motion picture, where we saw a different Star Trek and a different Starfleet, which was more to do with an organization which was a united humanity in exploring and being more scientific, because even their uniforms then actually looked more like scientists or medical officers, while this, they looked like buccaneers.
Down to bell bottoms as well.
Right, down to the bell bottoms. Yeah, very heavily naval influenced. Hornblower, a direct reference to Nick Meyer. It's not a coincidence. Nick Meyer referenced Hornblower. Turns out Shatner saw Hornblower in his portrayal as Kirk back in the day. Big fan of the Hornblower character, unbeknownst to Nick Meyer, it transpires. So a very nice coincidence there. I'm going to disagree with you because on the military thing, because in fact Starfleet uses military discipline, because space is dangerous and you need to have a command structure to stop people from dying of horrific accidents in space. And so you do have that. But actually Starfleet is part of the United Space Probe Agency and not actually military. And if you want more, you can go to Tomorrow Is Yesterday as a good reference for that. And also the third season of Enterprise goes into that, because they have the Makos on board, who are military, and there is conflict between Starfleet, who are non-military, and the Makos, who are military. So I will take you. So I would argue that actually that's an inauthentic perspective of Star Trek in Star Trek II, is this idea of using Starfleet as military. I would suggest to you that it doesn't matter a damn, but I think if you are the kind of person who likes to pick holes in the kind of people who like to pick holes, then you could use this as an example of how inauthentic Star Trek is still actually very, very good Star Trek.
Yes, I think you can, because I think that this is not only authentic Star Trek, this actually saves the whole franchise.
Well, Yes.
It saves the franchise, definitely.
Yes. I mean, it makes the franchise, doesn't it?
It reboots it.
I don't think really... Franchise was only a word that was used in the NFL back in 1981.
True.
But Star Trek is one of the original franchises.
Yeah.
I'm certain over time... I mean, if they can bring back Lost in Space, then they can bring back Star Trek. Eventually, it would have been brought back. But we may have had to have waited until this century before we saw another Star Trek after Star Trek II had it blown. And it could so easily have blown.
I think the mentions of sort of the militarism of the film are interesting when you look at the time it's set. Of course, this is early Reagan era.
Yeah.
But he hadn't really got into his stride as far as the Hawk Republican at that sort of stage.
No, true.
This is just after Carter, so this is when US foreign policy is actually
still quite benign, isn't it?
It's quite benign. You've just had the sort of like the Israel Egypt Accords and things like that.
Mm.
And there's also salt talks as well. So there is a softening here. Of course, it does get harder through the 80s. And of course, you know, they do flex their military muscles as well quite a bit. There is actually quite a space here after Vietnam as well.
Yeah.
And it's before that whole sort of retrospection of Vietnam really kicks in.
I would suggest to you that you're absolutely right. I'm not disputing your interpretation of history. What I would suggest, however, is that Reagan came in with a specific mandate from the people, and so that there was probably an appetite for a, shall we say, a more assertive foreign policy, and that's possibly what guys like Nemchik and others were arguing at the time.
I dispute some of that.
We're all disputing each other. It's great, isn't it?
In history, because the thing is that the American military project had actually been given quite a few black eyes at this time. Especially with the botched rescue attempt.
Yeah.
In Iran.
Yes. Mm. And there were quite a few other things right at the beginning. And actually Reagan himself, very similar to what Trump started off with in our present day, was talking about and looking at Carter and the overseas exploits not being very good, and actually he wanted to bring everyone back, but that changed later on, as Graham said about having the Hawks in the administration. But we digress, we're going away from Star Trek, and
we're establishing the backdrop of this is a significant film, and it lives in it's a product of its time. I think it's fair to discuss that.
But there are some also products in the way the structure goes in this, because you know we've seen that they failed with the motion picture and they went back to looking at the success of Star Trek, which is still running in syndication at the time. And then that, you know, the idea was actually making it more of a character piece, and obviously with a budget which has been slashed for such a big movie, because it looks big.
Yeah.
You know, even though you would know how much it compares to the original, the motion picture. They used things sparingly, and the way the actual structure itself for the whole of the story is like a proper episode, or the way they've actually got acts throughout the actual construction of the actual motion picture.
You were going to say something?
No, I think Derek brings an important point there. The fact that it is done on the cheap is one of the things that makes this so successful, I think. It really limits itself. And whereas the motion picture said this is no longer a TV show, the Wrath of Khan brings it all back in.
He says, oh, yes, it is.
Wrath of Khan could easily be a made-for-TV film.
Yeah.
And that's not a criticism by any stretch.
No.
Because basically it was using sets that were there for Phase 2. And it's using a lot of the ideas that they were going to use for Phase 2 as well. And it just goes with it. They don't bring in Star Trek people to do it. They bring in people who have to get the old reels and sit down and watch all of the episodes to come up with an idea of what they want to do.
This is the big strength of the movie. Yeah. I think this is why the movie works. There's a number of reasons why this movie works really well, but at the heart of it is because they were not sort of like devoted fans.
Yeah.
They did have some people on the senior people who were fans, but not the key decision makers, and they were helped. And I think that probably did help them with some of the more authentic aspects of it. But the fact is that they expertised themselves on Star Trek in a very short space of time, and then went, right, okay. And also they were very good filmmakers.
Yeah.
Or really, well, Harve Bennett was the executive producer, was a TV guy, and clearly had been brought in because he said, look, we're going to basically make a movie of the week, only we're going to put it in the cinema. It's only going to have a slightly bigger budget than a movie on the week. Star Trek II's initial budget was $8 million. But after a few weeks, the execs looked at it and said, this is going really well, let's up the budget, give them a bit more money. But it's still $12 million, which is, even then, is very small. And I think what was Motion Picture was 40, something like that. I mean, Motion Picture was a successful movie, but in so many ways it wasn't.
It made more money than Wrath of Khan, but obviously because it was made for so much more, the margins look a lot less.
Look a lot less. I mean, Wrath of Khan made, what, $95 million worldwide, which is a lot.
Yeah.
Which is a lot, and it broke records on opening weekend, which is very important. And you can see why, because I mean they led with the fact that like Spock was going to die in this film, so everyone knows who Spock is. So they all turned up to see Spock die, and what they got was actually a really very very good film. And I think bringing in Harve Bennett was a good idea. I'm reminded of your Harve Bennett anecdote from I can't remember which podcast we did about and the idea of the outgoing Gene Roddenberry who was kicked upstairs. After having, well, frankly, botched the production of Motion Picture and was told, look, go on, off you go, and was given the executive consultant role, Harve Bennett brought in, and Nick Meyer, who a very talented and skilled filmmaker. And I think that Star Trek was lucky to get Nick Meyer coming in to work on this when he did, and things may well have been different if they'd gone in another direction.
Well, I mean, the difference between the two productions that were done before is night and day. I'd also say that sort of like they obviously the humanity has been brought up in the whole thing with it, and the sense of soap opera throughout, which makes it very successful. I mean, this is a film that you could have taken, you know, when it opened up, you took the kids, you took your grandparents and everyone, there is something for everyone, the whole thing. And also it's a multi-generational film through the characters, because you've got the setup of new characters coming in with Savick, who's like the next generation of, you know, you've also got the introduction of, you know, Kirk's son, another next generation, and the whole thing which starts off, which is about age, you know, about people who are, you know, Kirk and his not facing up to his own, or there's a conflict there between whether he's facing up to his own mortality and not facing up to his mortality.
Yeah, let's explore that in a moment. But before we do that, but just to pick up on what you just said a few seconds earlier, Graham, this movie is incredibly visceral, isn't it? It's a very emotional film by comparison to The Motion Picture, for example.
Yeah.
I mean, everybody in this movie is pretty much strung out.
Yeah.
You know, everyone is like, you've got Kirk, who's confronted by his age, his status, his son, an old enemy that he'd probably forgotten about and didn't realise is out to get him. You've got Spock, who confesses his undying love for Kirk, and you know, and obviously making the ultimate sacrifice. You've got even McCoy, who is, on the one hand, you know, supporting his friend in this moment of crisis, and then losing his cool completely when he discovers the existence of Genesis, that such a thing is not only being conceived but is also about to be implemented, and is appalling. You know, Savick is struggling, you know, with her new status, and you know, David is angry and confronted by, you know, Carol Marcus is, you know, everyone's really emotional. Everybody is, and Khan is hugely emotional about the whole thing. Everyone's really angry or sad, and you know, it's such a different change. It's a fucking, it makes it a completely different movie. to the motion picture. That it, the two are almost completely unrecognisable. There's drama in the motion picture, but it's far more mauve than it is. Whereas everyone's really on it, you know, in this one. It's fantastic.
Yeah, well, that's because it is so well written and so well done and so well characterised. They know the characters inside out. They look at the key characters, don't they? And they give the key characters the most amount of screen time on there, which is
what you should do.
Which is what you should do. None of this just farting around with the extras, basically just to give them a bit of screen time to keep the fans happy. There's none of that here. they just concentrate on the key characters, and everyone who's introduced gets something. There is something, as you say, conflict and resolution there. But it's easily understandable. You quickly pick up what Carol Marcus's motivations are. She's got so many motivations. She's got her son working on this. She's got her ex-boyfriend who she thinks is trying to mess things up. She's got basically a death weapon that she's working with, and so much is going on in there. But you know, she gets very, very few lines in this.
Yeah. No, it's
and you get all of this from a very, very small amount.
The economy of words that they used, and in conjunction with the superior acting. I mean, because the only rookie actor on that show is Kirstie Alley, who acknowledged. I listened to her when I went to a convention in Vegas. She did a rare appearance and was and talked about. She was quite open about it. She said, "Look, I wasn't professional. I came in. I thought that. I mean, I'd landed this great role in the Star Trek. It's a big. I know it was a cheap movie, but it was a huge name. And I was good. And I wasn't professional. I was out drinking every night. And I know I wasn't taking the job seriously. It came to me too soon. And she suspects that's why she never really got picked up for Star Trek 3 is because they didn't want to work with her.
Yeah.
She was quite difficult, but she was also amazing.
She was amazing.
Right?
Yeah,
I mean, I saw this movie when I was 13, and you can imagine the effects that it had. I think we understand who David is to a certain degree and who Carol is to a certain degree in that very brief exchange on Regular One, the overgrown boy scout exchange, which is what, 2 minutes of dialogue, and we're filled in.
Yeah,
I mean, it's really, really, really good. Great storytelling, and like I said, really well delivered. And one of my favourite scenes is also Kirk and Carol, and Kirk is just sitting there looking utterly dejected, you know, having been confronted with an awful lot of his, you know, poor choices that he's made, whether they be good choices or bad choices, whether they be right or wrong choices. You know, and the whole, you know, there's a man out there, haven't seen 15 years, trying to kill, and all of that, and then Carol's sort of like offering him, you know, a new future and something, some hope through the whole thing. Absolutely beautifully rendered, beautifully written, and done, you know, with no money at all, you know, just pure drama and great script writing. And this is one of the reasons why this movie holds up so well, is because it's actually a good movie.
Yeah, I mean, these days, this is 13 episodes on Netflix, isn't it?
Yeah.
This one film, because it's got so much in it.
Yeah.
And you know, you'd be carried away with that. I mean, it would work as well.
You think about going back to Discovery, I think some of the sequences between Michael Burnham and Ash Tyler in second season 2 of Discovery are just like so drawn out, so long, you know, so over dramatized, and it's cringeworthy. And I maybe in a modern audience get on with that. But I mean, I find it's like, get on with it, you know.
Yeah.
This is tedious.
Yeah.
You know, just get on with it. You know, it's not like, and not in a kind of, you know, Kelly McGillis and Tom Cruise Top Gun kind of way. You know, just kiss her, will you? Because that was all part of the thing. But being able to convey drama, knowing that you've only got a small amount of money and a certain amount of time to do it, it's not a lost art by any means.
No.
But when your purpose of drama is to stretch it out as long as you can, it's in danger of becoming a lost art.
But this is what makes Wrath of Khan for me more like the TV show, because it's got that economy there in the dialogue, where you know you're using, albeit one dimensional characters, but it's just there to be signposts for the viewer, just so you don't need to know the backstory. You don't need to know what happened
no.
between Kirk and Carol.
Because it's there.
At all. Because you can guess. You can just put all the pieces together yourself. You don't need to have it all explained to you.
Yeah.
Well, you shouldn't need
Do. I mean, maybe if you're young and inexperienced, you might not do. But anyone who's lived any kind of life, has been in any kind of relationship, will understand immediately that on a human level that, you know, there's been some stuff gone down. And then there's this tall guy who looks a bit like him, you know, wandering around with curly blonde hair and going, what's going on? Looking all confused and thinking, well, there you go. You know, and you don't need to be a Star Trek fan to understand that you need to be a human being for the most part. And, you know.
And of course, it shows that the knowledge of the character as well. That dialogue you say, the overgrown Boy Scout and things like that. And then all of a sudden, you know, you've got an abandoned child there as well. And it probably is all the criticism that was ever probably put towards someone like Captain Kirk in all those years between the TV series and when the films came out. And so all this thing about, well, you know, Star Trek, there it is. Oh, yeah, it's great. Look, here's this overgrown Boy Scout running around the universe, shagging women. So I think it's great that the writers looked at this and thought, yeah, okay, well, let's try and get under his skin a bit.
Yeah.
And here we go. We've got a vulnerable one as well. This is the guy who is now changed into desk jockey who thinks that galloping around the cosmos is a game
for the young.
Yeah.
And again, a good, really, I mean, beautiful use, Derek, also of sets as well, because the Kobayashi Maru sequence, which of course is a significant theme of the movie, and that's the confrontation of mortality and death and all of that. Using the Enterprise Bridge, because so much of this movie was filmed on that one set, the Enterprise Bridge, because the Reliant Bridge was redressed from the Enterprise Bridge, I think, and so filmed separately. So again, good use of budget while doing that. But also that whole scene sets everything up very nicely for the tone of the movie, doesn't it?
It does. It's a great scene. I mean, I remember the first time I saw it. You know, the first time you see this movie and that's set up, you don't expect what happens.
No, because the audience is expecting Spock to die, and then he dies in the opening sequence, isn't it? And then at that point, the audience is going, oh, we've been duped here, guys.
Well,
we might as well stay and watch this movie anyway.
Well, this is the thing. I mean, this has got lots of influences. I mean, it's got the MacGuffins that go through this, and the MacGuffins obviously been made very famous with Hitchcock, a lot of look one way, I'm doing something else. And it's all the way through this movie. You know, you've got things, you expect it to go one direction. So the first time you see this movie, you will love it. The second time, you would love it maybe even more, because you'll spot things, more things, layers and layers and layers as you go along. It's a lovely package, you know. The opening sequence when, you know, again, you know, it's not the Enterprise. They're on a training deck, which is in a starship somewhere, or it could be on Earth. We don't know, but it's not the Enterprise, but it looks like it. And you expected all that excitement in the first couple of minutes is brilliant, and then it goes into the nice little come down when it starts with a human story. You're being reintroduced to the characters that you might know of, or if you've never seen them before, you're given a really nice condensed little story that you can relate to.
The scene between Kirk and McCoy in the birthday scene, the glasses, the Romulan ale, you know, Kirk's got this fantastic pad, right, overlooking San Francisco Bay. You know, I mean, like, in many, many ways, he should be at the top of his game, right? This is Imperial phase Kirk in many ways, because he's got it all. You know, he's got the great antique collection, he's got the fantastic pad, he's got a great job, you know, got a huge amount of status, but he's ultimately forlorn because he's not fulfilling his destiny. And then we have this conversation and argument between Kirk and McCoy, which is such an important one, because again, it reinforces to Star Trek fans the Kirk McCoy friendship and the nature of that friendship very well. And it also tells new audiences exactly who these people are. And you don't have to have watched a single minute of Star Trek to know who these people are.
It's interesting also that it's also it's a reversal of the motion picture in a certain way.
Which you did have to see almost probably all 79 episodes.
But there is the reversal is that obviously you know, in that one, you left an admiral who basically usurped another captain. While in this one, you've got an admiral who doesn't want to take the captain's chair. While his mate, who was telling him he shouldn't have taken in the last movie, that's McCoy, he was actually saying you shouldn't be doing this. He's actually trying to convince him to do it.
Yeah, he does. He says, you know, take back your command, doesn't he? Just McCoy. Yeah. Indeed, Spock says the same thing. It was a mistake for you to accept promotion.
Yeah. It doesn't mean to say that he actually makes the right choices in this film.
Let's ask this question now then. Does Spock make the right choice? Should he have given Kirk command
now,
of the Enterprise?
Spock messes this up royally.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, he does.
Yeah.
Because Kirk,
it's not Kirk's fault.
Kirk does react in tactical situations quite well to get himself themselves out of this. But the reason, he was very clever to come up with the idea of hacking, of taking Reliance PIN number and then hacking, which is really very 1981 way of hacking into. It's a great idea.
Yeah.
It's a great idea.
Single authentication. Oh, bloody hell!
I know. Those are the dangers of single authentication, listeners. No, you've been warned. It's that easy. A very, very basic way of doing it, but actually a very, very smart idea for. And you just obviously, you know. Based upon 81's conceptions of encryption and cyber security, he does have some quite good ideas, and I like the kind of hours and days kind of things quite cute. I liked that. I did enjoy his whole, you know, I don't like to lose thing, the confidence that he's got when he's in the Genesis cave. And can we also acknowledge Star Trek 09 because Kirk is talking about Kobayashi Maru and he's eating an apple.
Yeah.
In Star Trek 09,
yes.
Kirk is doing the Kobayashi Maru and he's eating an apple.
Yes.
I thought that was a nice touch.
It was a nice
touch. Which I appreciated at the time.
It is nice because he's put in situations where he does get to show off his skill as a commander.
But the reason why they're there is all because he's made poor choices, right?
Yes. But this happens in so many films, doesn't it? Where the hero is wrong all the way through it and is allowed to redeem himself, dig himself out of the hole that he created for himself.
Yeah, except he doesn't know Dale, does he? Somebody else has to dig him out of it for him.
Well, he has quite a few people dig him out for him.
True.
The sacrifices that are made throughout this...
Dead cadets.
Yeah, dead cadets. That's what I was thinking first, and then obviously the big boy with the ears who gets who has to save the day really, you know.
But it's quite interesting because I think when Spock is on the bridge there, and that moment on the bridge when Kirk is like, we won't catalogue Kirk's errors, but they begin with him not obviously taking necessary precautions when the Reliant approaches. And then he's just so worried about, obviously, his son and the mother of his son, that it informs, I think, his decisions, and he ends up making wrong choices. And we reach a point at the climax of the movie where Spock, and I like to think that in that second where Spock, with the Genesis device is about to be detonated, they're all going to die. They need warp speed back online. And he's sitting there going, I really shouldn't have given this guy the captaincy because he's now over there. He's completely lost his shit. He doesn't know what to do. He's floundering. And almost every step of the way, he's made wrong choices. And now I need to be able to take control of this situation.
But this,
and so he does it.
This is the constant theme of the no-win scenario all the way through, isn't it? And it's where Kirk does find a way out of it, largely due to the people surrounding him. And then, like, how many times did it happen in the TV show that Spock would be the one who would come up with the solution? And in this occasion, even Spock can't come up with a solution.
No, that doesn't involve
at least somebody dying.
Somebody has to die.
Yeah,
exactly. And he makes the call because he ultimately is the captain of the ship. He's relinquished control to a senior, to a admiral. And is now having to pay the ultimate price.
Yeah, how many times have we seen it? Eh? The admiral, the bad admiral comes.
The concept
along.
Of the bad admiral and Kirk in this instance.
That's Kirk is the bad admiral.
Yeah. I mean, he has his moments, and he is great, and it's not all about that. And But I don't know whether or not the movie really acknowledges that aspect of it. Do you think that the movie acknowledges that?
Yeah, it's weird because I think in this one, he has bigger fish to fry than the Enterprise, and I think that's what we see usually in the film is in the show is the Kirk love of the ship.
Mm.
And in this occasion, it's not. It's more about he's got other things on his mind in this. So it is a slightly different set of priorities from it. But
do you think TOS Kirk would have rushed down to engineering and run in there and fixed the warp drive on the ship? Or do you think he would have ordered Scotty to go in there and do it?
I don't know, whatever was I good for the writer.
Depends on whether let us speculate as to what we think. What would we think is more consistent behaviour? Therefore,
what he does is consistent. I think
really,
yeah, I think this is what he is faced now with the no-win scenario because it's going to blow up and everyone's going to die.
Yeah,
and I think it's only Spock can work out the fact that actually no. There is a way out of this.
Yeah,
I can't explain. I'm just gonna go and
do
it. Yeah, because only I can do it. If Scotty does this, he'll be dead before.
Yeah, he won't make it. The only person who can make it in there, and he makes that. And there's again that beautiful exchange between McCoy and Spock just before he goes into the chamber.
Yeah,
to say as you are so fond of reminding me, I'm not human.
Yeah,
and it's a slightly clunky dialogue. Human can tolerate. Are you out of your Vulcan mind?
Yeah.
No human can tolerate. But then Yeah. But then it does. It's a nice setup, and it does work. And it does work well. And I think that scene is really, really, extremely well done. Again, given the budget and props to Jimmy Doohan's voice acting, because he does convey. I mean, really, what's happening is there's this guy running around in an empty room with some big gloves on, and that's all he's doing. And really, we don't necessarily understand the danger of that, of what he's doing, is not being conveyed to us. The only way we really truly understand what's happening there is what is Scotty's exhortations for him to get out of there, because he knows that with every second that passes, he's going to, the chances are he won't survive the whole thing. And I thought that that's pretty good acting and good direction there, because that could easily be just like I don't know what's happening here. Again, another example of just how well made this movie is. I think what we can probably say is that Kirk made some poor choices, but it's consistent with the setup of the movie.
It's consistent,
and they're understandable choices, and that's why people like the film.
I mean, it's consistent with the mythology of Kirk as well. I mean, which has been built on since then as well. I mean, the idea about the reboot of Trek. Made Kirk even more reckless in the Trek 09, the idea of the character being a bit more rogue, and this did this sort of, because we you had so many years of TOS where you've had different parts of Kirk's characters come through. This just focused on that one part, and obviously the friendship part of it,
I mean the
built up for that,
the fact that they concentrated on the trio I think was really wise, and the scene in Kirk's quarters where they unfold Genesis, which is a fantastic idea, a brilliant idea for a setup. We've not talked about Khan at all.
Well, that's it. I was just going to say about the mirror.
But we're running out of time.
But then again, that's part of this, isn't it? Really, because even though he's got star billing and it's his name on the actual on the billboard. it's not about him.
It's not
all,
about
is
him,
it?
Really.
He's just someone who is just causing a mess while Kirk has his midlife crisis.
He's just a villain because it's like Ming the Merciless.
He's a metaphor. Representation of Kirk's anxiety.
Yes.
The reason why they never met, I'm sure, was probably because just down to budget. It's a perfect example of fashioning beautiful art out of really difficult circumstances. And it was great that they never, because in many ways you could argue we never met. This could easily be a Jim Kirk fever dream.
Yeah.
And not actually any of it be real. It's a story. It's a fable.
Well, it's a myth. The whole thing is a myth.
The whole thing cooked up out of a whole bottle of 2283 Romulan ale.
They could do a cut of this where you removed all the Khan sequences, and then I wonder what it would be like if you removed all the Khan all the other sequences where Kirk's not in this movie and then stitched it along and see whether or not it would work. And then just have it only as Kirk in it. And so it is actually just like a coming out of the shower kind of thing. Or, yeah, as you say, a Romulan and ale induced, you know, drunken episode. And he wakes up the following day and went, my God.
Opens up the curtains. Still San Francisco. Right?
Still San Francisco. And goes, you know what? I think I might get my old job back. Can we just reflect? I mean, let's just quickly reflect then on Khan, and also reflect on the, because we talked a lot about Khan in our last episode, Spacey, though. I don't think we need to go too much into it, but I mean, what a tour de force by Ricardo Montalban. And again, artful use of classical references in order to reinforce the intensity of the character by the writers as well. You know, the Moby Dick references and stuff like that.
This film is still a Kirk vehicle. So the idea that you have the villain, who's the main villain against him, is the mirror of him. And we've seen that in our previous episode when we spoke about that Khan was basically the same type of character as Kirk, you know, in physical prowess and also tactical. They were quite similar because Kirk beat him before, you know, tactically, and there was a grudge and respect. Perfect, you know, foil for this.
Yeah, although of course in this episode, in this film, it's Spock who beats him tactically. Isn't
yes,
because Spock suggests that he, you know, go down.
In many ways, it was Spock who beat him tactically the first time.
That's a very good point, Graham. It's a very good point. Yeah, that's very true. A few words on Khan, but also, I mean, the reference to Marla MacGyver's in there, who sadly would have been in this movie were it not for her untimely death.
Yeah, she would have been.
And that would have been amazing, I think, wouldn't it?
Yes, it would have been. It would have been. But as well, if she had been there, then I think it would have been that we would have seen perhaps more of the character of Khan there as well, the other side of him that we do see in Space Seed. But he is still a tyrant, and he's good enough just to have him there as the tyrant.
Do you think you
have to rely on Joachim?
Joachim kind of stands in to a certain degree, you know, in maybe what. So you think that what would have happened is Marla would have been more involved in that kind of byplay, and Joachim probably wouldn't have happened as a character. It would have been
As he was in the Space Age, somebody turns up as Marla.
Are we thinking about Joachim? I mean, you know, what are we thinking about Joachim and
well,
Khan?
He's important. He is important.
Clearly, they are deeply, very, very. They enjoy a very
son,
close relationship.
He's his son.
Son or lover? What do you think? Father, son.
Yeah, because you've already got that with Kirk and his newfound son as well.
Righto.
So there is again. There's that sort of.
Towards the end, when he's openly defying him, they're really, really nice moments. And again, virtually no backstory between them. Just pure acting and dialogue, just conveying to the audience that these two have a deep connection and they probably quarrel quite a lot based upon love. And you allow yourself to feel sorry for Khan when Joachim is killed at the end, I guess. He's a kind of villain that you admire, right? I think.
Definitely.
I would say that's one of the reasons why all the best villains are ones that there's an element to them that you can relate to.
It's the Moriarty, the end sequence, obviously, with the main sort of showdown in the nebula is your typical sort of American submarine commander versus German submarine commander. It's, you know, that grudging respect.
Interesting how they have those two battles there. Because the second one is a lot more like Balance of Terror, isn't it? Where you've got that sort of the tension building up, the use of three dimensions it works really well. Whereas the first one is harkening back to those old tall ships again, isn't it?
The two
of them just slowly moving up, broadsiding exactly, and it's such a change of pace from what the space battles were in Star Wars.
Yeah.
Which are dogfights, aren't they?
Yeah.
You have the Star Cruisers, but they're almost as space stations, aren't they?
Exactly.
The real battle is done by
is the TIE fighters and the X-Wings, isn't it?
And that's what makes it a nice change of pace, and because you don't have the fighters in there, you've got these big cumbersome ships.
It's torturous, isn't it? The phaser fire.
Yes.
Hammering the engineering section is like...
Yeah, and you can see inside there as well. It's not just boom, that's it, gone.
The,
it?
the initial fight, the battle between the two, I mean, and the carnage in the engine room and the panic.
Mm.
These are things you don't see in, you've never would have seen in a Star Trek episode, because they just, no one can, you can't, you know, choreograph a battle on that scale with on a TV budget, especially in the 1960s. And it was just something else. And it's very, again, very visceral. You know, there's just so much emotion going on here. You know, no one's just, people aren't just dying. They're dying screaming. These are young men dying screaming, and it's chilling and very
also
authentic.
There's the blame as well. I mean, the bit with Scotty taking his nephew.
Yeah.
He doesn't go to the medical.
Well, we don't
department.
Know he's his nephew in this movie. There's a in the director's cut, it's explained, but the director's cut is clunky in my opinion, and actually the better version is the one without that. But again, I was thinking closely about this at the time when I watched it on Wednesday before in preparation for this, and I thought we don't need to know. We know this kid is close to Scotty because he's gone to the bridge with him.
Yeah.
So he's clearly, it matters. We don't need to know the rest.
Yeah,
it's not important.
No, I think it's one part of the overarching theme of family throughout the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone's it. Joachim is Khan's family. We realise that Kirk's family isn't Carol and David. It's McCoy and Spock.
Yeah,
that's who his family is, and that's why him being alone in his apartment, why he's adrift.
Yeah,
isn't it really? I think. Because it never hides any of its references or metaphors in this film. You know exactly what this is all about. It's about life and death. But the constant theme of family and it making sense out of death, it always comes back. And I think you can see why the writers might have wanted to include that as well in there. But you're right, it doesn't need it, because it comes across how important it is.
Yeah, it doesn't. I mean, we don't need it to spell out who this guy is to Scotty. It's clear that he's important to
him. It's like the relationship between Savick and Spock as well, isn't it?
Yes.
They have a very, very, very brief interchange, don't they, in Vulcan, which is brilliant.
Yeah.
But that also gives you an idea of a bonding between the two of them. And
you've seen quite a few of those little bits. I mean, the bit where...
Yeah, it runs all the way through, doesn't it?
You know, there are those connections. It is all about relationships with people. You know, and I actually like the Savick and the Spock relationship because it's like his protege, and I like the bit when, you know, he gets up off the out of the captain's chair to let Savick to move in there, you know, and that's a lovely little piece there, sort of like, you know, it's your turn now, I trust you to do this.
We should be wrapping up quite soon, but I want to just go over a couple of technical aspects of it, which may be of some interest to you, or maybe of some interest to the listeners. It was very, very cheap film. They borrowed quite heavily from the motion picture, the space dock sequences straight out of motion picture. Regular One, very clever. They used the autumn orbiting space station, turned it upside down. Very, very clever. Speaking of upside downs, the Reliant.
Yes.
Nick Meyer, Harve Bennett pulled out the plans for the Reliant, pulled them out upside down. Said, that looks great. Signed it. And they went, so you want it that way up? Obviously, I've signed the form. What's being suggested?
I thought that was brilliant.
You're suggesting I've not paid attention. That was very funny.
But it works so well.
The Reliant is a beautifully
designed
ship, isn't it?
Instantly, you've got the separation. You've got the difference between the two with the engines underneath rather than the engines on top.
Yeah.
So it makes it a lot easier for.
But still, the same design principles
of a
main saucer and then the nacelles. Very, very consistent with Matt Jeffrey's design, which is what we like. I'm ashamed to say I don't recall who designed the Reliant, but I'm afraid not. Let's just have a few words about some other aspects, technical aspects, actually, that were quite pioneering for this movie. First movie to do significant amounts of computer graphics.
Yes.
The opening sequence to this movie is computer-generated CGI. Very, very important to establish that they've done that as a cost-cutting measure. They did it. Actually ended up being quite pioneering, and the Genesis simulation generated by the same people at the division of Lucasfilm that then went on to form Pixar. So the legacy of this movie is more than just, you know, beyond Star Trek. It also has a technical legacy that goes on as well, and some of the best movies ever made and some of the most lucrative films ever made came, you know, in some small degree from Wrath of Khan. I think that's worth noting that although the film was made on the cheap, it was not you know, it was in some respects a pioneering movie and an important film. One day I think we would talk about Into Darkness, its kind of mirror universe equivalent. But all I would say is just to go back to that viscerality, that emotion, that high emotion involved in this movie. They tried to do that with Into Darkness, and the reason why the film fails to do that is because it fails to replicate that degree of emotional reaction and viscerality in the movie. And they make a crucial mistake of flipping it around and making Spot the Khan guy. You know, the guy who... I mean, that's just awful. And I think that's one of the reasons why that movie doesn't work on that level. It doesn't connect on an emotional level, I think. And that's why it fails. And that's why this movie is so good. And a succession of Star Trek movies that try to ape Wrath of Khan fail because they can't match that emotional level. The closest came, I think, was First Contact. I think Picard and his obsession with the Borg is as close as you can get to that, being able to plunge to reach those emotional heights or depths. And I think that's the big takeaway from this movie. I was going to go on about James Horner's soundtrack, but I'm sorry to say that we're running out of time.
Well, that's very sad.
So it is, but it is a good. Well, maybe one day we'll do a musical episode and we can spend more about James Horner's soundtrack. But I mean, I will say it's a vital component of this movie, worthy of another 10 minutes discussion.
Except for one thing.
Go on.
Bagpipes.
The bagpipes. Not everyone likes the bagpipes, do they?
No.
Yeah.
I think
this is my hot take, right? Actually, Scotty decided that he wanted to do a two fingers up to Spock, who's on his way out the tube, because he knew that Spock hated bagpipes because of his enhanced hearing.
Interesting. They were actually James Doohan's idea, the bagpipes.
Yeah.
Maybe they should have.
Well, but obviously, like, no one was going to be able to play Spock's lyre, was there, were they? So,
no, yeah. Sadly.
Yeah, and that's what he really would have wanted, is his closing music.
Yeah, amazing, and a rendition of Amazing Grace with his Vulcan lyre, with his, well, like, you know, bicycle wheel. All right, then. Well, I think on that note, and to quote Pavel Chekhov, we have to get out of here now because we've got football to watch and beer to drink.
Yes, we do.
So thank you very much indeed for listening. This is probably going to be a longer episode, but then I'm sure you can appreciate why. If you haven't seen Star Trek 2 recently, go and watch it again. It's a cracking film. Thank you very much indeed. And so thank you, Derek. Thank you, Graham, for your time. And until our next episode, which will be about Star Trek, it's goodbye.
Goodbye.